I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is comedian Joel Chasnoff, a very funny and very Jewish guy. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Today is the fifth day of Hanukkah. Tonight, the sixth of the eight crazy nights we celebrate this wintertime holiday. We are now in the midst of the Festival of Lights, which really should be known as the Festival of Dedication. Why, Rabbi, you ask? I'll tell you why. First, Hanukkah actually means dedication in Hebrew, a reminder of the fact that our ancestors cleansed and rededicated the Holy Temple in Jerusalem at this time of year in those days, 2,180 years ago or so. Second, it should be called the Festival of Dedication because it took great dedication to their own religious identity for the Maccabees to retain their beliefs and culture in the face of severe persecution. And third, Hanukkah should be considered the holiday of dedication because knowing the high price our people has paid over the centuries for being Jewish, it's part of our birthright to affirm religious freedom for every people in every place in the world at every point in history. Which brings us to a news story that has greater implications than may appear on the surface. This past week, our friend and multiple past guest on Two Jewish, Rabbi David Saperstein, was confirmed as the newest U.S. Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, and the first non-Christian in that post. President Barack Obama announced the appointment in late July, but it took this long for the Senate to get around to confirming it. Saperstein has been the director and chief legal counsel for the Union of Reform Judaism's Religious Action Center, the political and legislative outreach arm of Reform Judaism in America. He's been in that position for over 30 years, and he shaped it into a critically important position in American Judaism, advocating for justice. Well, for those of you who, like me, had no idea that we actually have an ambassador at large for religious freedom, or that it's in the U.S. State Department, this is a surprising but nice moment. Since Rabbi Saperstein's confirmation came just in time for Hanukkah, the ultimate festival of religious freedom, I thought this fit well with the theme of the actual status of religious freedom in the world today. The other side of that is that there's actually some unbelievably terrible religious persecution going on right now in the world, and it's high time someone, anyone, took the lead on addressing it. I'm going to firmly recommend to Rabbi Saperstein that this might be the issue he should champion first. And this time, the people being persecuted are not Jews. Although there are always incidents, and we certainly report them faithfully here on Two Jewish. But the people who are being brutally persecuted now are not Jews. They are also not Muslims, nor are they Buddhists or Hindus or Sikhs. The people being horribly, infamously, brutally persecuted today are Christians in the Middle East. And for reasons that I simply don't get, the Christian world seems astonishingly, shockingly, inappropriately quiet about the whole thing. I'm not really sure it's my place as a rabbi to point this out to my clerical colleagues in churches throughout the West, but it's worth noting that the most persecuted minority in the world today consists of Christian communities in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, in Nigeria, in Pakistan, in other Arab countries, and in the Palestinian-controlled areas. A report came out recently confirming that religious freedom is on the decline virtually everywhere around the world, even in Europe. But it is Muslim countries that dominate the list of places where religious freedom is most under threat. And the most striking and horrifying example has been the systematic destruction of ancient Christian communities in Iraq and Syria by ISIS, the Islamic State. While the majority of the many people these fanatics have slaughtered have been Muslims, the annihilation of entire Christian communities going on right now is simply horrific. But ISIS, or ISIL if you will, is not alone. There have also been severe persecutions and massacres of Coptic Christians in Egypt, of Nigerian Christians by Boko Haram in Nigeria, and the less publicized but systematic suppression of Christians in Gaza by Hamas, and in the West Bank by the moderate Palestinian Authority, practices that date back to the days of Yasser Arafat. Christians and even entire Christian communities continue to flee the Middle East, seeking safety and religious freedom, as we Jews have had to do in every century. And shockingly, the many, many, many churches in America and Britain and France and Canada and the rest of the West seem neither to have noticed nor particularly cared. You know, as a Jew, I just don't get it. We have often been powerless to stop the persecution of our own people, but we have always tried hard to focus world attention on their plight. Today, when there are over 2 billion Christians on Earth, one out of every 3 human beings on the planet, and there is no doubt that Christianity claims the adherence of the most powerful nations and people and leaders in the world, almost nothing on the subject. I hope I'm not stepping too far over boundaries here, but on this festival of religious freedom, Hanukkah, and as we approach the birthday of the entire Christian faith, I urge you to begin to think about ways to raise this issue of the persecution of Christians. It needs to be addressed. Perhaps Rabbi David Saperstein can raise it on behalf of the United States as our ambassador at large for religious freedom. Because the outrage of Christians being persecuted and slaughtered for their faith must be stopped, particularly all over the Middle East. We need to speak out loudly and consistently. It is wrong. To play us in this morning on this fifth day of Hanukkah on the theme of religious freedom, here's the great cantor and opera star Jan Pierce singing Hanerot Halalu and Al Hanisim, reminding us of the miracles that God did for our ancestors at this time, protecting our religious freedom. That was cantor and operatic tenor Jan Pierce singing Hanerot Halalu for the Festival of Religious Freedom we celebrate now. When we come back in a few moments on To Jewish, we'll meet Joel Chazanoff, the highly intelligent and very Jewish comedian who grew up in America, survived the Israeli army, and makes every Jewish experience funny and interesting, including the holiday of Hanukkah. Find out how when we come back soon on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
We're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, comedian Joel Chesnoff. He's one of the most enjoyable and entertaining Jewish comedians, which includes, you know, frankly, nearly all the comedians in the world, has a fascinating background and a strong connection both to Israel and America and Jewish day schools and all kinds of good stuff. Good morning and welcome, Joel.
Good morning, Sam. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I should say happy Hanukkah. This is an exciting morning. Any particular associations with Hanukkah?
Well, you know, one of the first jokes I ever wrote, and I must admit, 12 years later, 10 years later, however long it's been, it's still in my ass because some of the favorites stick around. It was a Hanukkah joke. I wrote a joke, I think, when I was in college about how we Jews tend to ruin holidays with foods, and Hanukkah was the first example I pulled out, that we eat this potato pancake to celebrate the fact that the oil lasted 8 days. We eat the potato pancake, which has more oil, I think 8 times the amount of oil than the Food and Drug Administration, something like that. So yeah, that was I guess there's a sentimental memory there because that was one of the first jokes I ever wrote.
So it was sort of the joke that kept on giving, if you think about it.
Very seasonal reference, yeah.
When you start to sit down to write jokes, I mean, do you sit down to write jokes? Does a great idea come to you at 3 a.m. and you pop up and start scribbling or typing furiously? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I do keep a pad of paper and pen next to the bed. Rarely that I'll wake up, but just so it's always there. Often when I'm, you know, just sort of getting ready to go to sleep, I'll have an idea or two, and I'm too lazy to get up and go somewhere else to get a pen, so I keep it right next to the bed. Because you never do know when it will strike, and I've learned the hard way that no matter how great the idea is, if you don't write it down within a minute, it's gone.
Is humor, you know, you've written books also, you've worked in other media. Is writing comedy different in different avenues?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'd done stand-up for maybe 7 years before I sat down to write the book, the memoir about my Israeli army service. It's called The 188th Crybaby Brigade. And when you do stand-up, you're very much looking for a setup and then a punchline, so you get that laugh. And you can also gauge how you're doing. So if you do a joke, you know, 3 times at 3 different shows and it gets no reaction, you know it's out. And likewise, if you get a great reaction, you know to keep it and hone it. With writing for the page, you don't have that set up punchline system. I found that the humor comes from, at least for me, it comes from being very honest about unusual circumstances, but not using fancy words, not trying to be funny, but just plainly stating the truth. That, for me, is what funny writing is, when you state an absurdity honestly on the page. And it did take me a little while to learn that difference.
We will talk much more with Joel Chesnoff, one of the really terrific Jewish comedians working today, when we come back in a few moments on this Hanukkah edition of Two Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as Very Popular Podcasts. We welcome our Mivi Nahan, Israel Oshrat Bariel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Chag Chanukah Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
So there's a special greeting that we give, that they give in Israel, that I didn't know until I went to Israel. What do you say in Israel on Chanukah? It's not just Chag Sameach. Chag Urim Sameach?
Chag Urim Sameach, yeah. Like the festive of light.
Right, the light, happy light holiday, or is probably the best way to describe it. Hanukkah is a great time in Israel. To explain what a sufganiyah is, because people in America think it's a jelly donut if they know anything about it, but it's not really.
First, it's delicious.
Yes.
So it's a dough. It's like a kind of a roll, but a delicious dough, fried.
Deep fried.
Deep fried. And then some of them, in Israel, it become like something, it used to be only with a red jelly, with
like
a strawberry.
Raspberry or strawberry jelly, right?
Inside. That's what we used to eat for many, many years. But for the past years, all kind of boutique pastry came up with all kind of toppings. So you have like 1,000 choices.
Different, all kinds of sufganiyah.
For a great, great sufganiyah, different sizes, different shapes. You know, Israel, startup nation, also with sufganiyot.
So now we have like startup sufganiyot.
Yes.
What's the weirdest sufganiyah you've ever had? Remember, we're eating anything fried in oil this week in celebration of the miracle of the oil and the light and the menorah at the temple a long time ago, more than 2,000 years ago. But it's guaranteed not to have any cholesterol or fat for the week of Hanukkah. It's a Jewish guarantee.
Mm-hmm. It's the same guarantee that none of the Shabbat food is
unhealthy or creates cholesterol. Thank you. What's the weirdest sufganiyah you've had?
Rabbi, I'm an Israeli. There is no weird sufganiyah. I don't know. I ate all of them and I liked all of them.
They all taste good.
Yeah.
On Hanukkah, it's also customary in Israel. There's lots of shows and other festivals.
Yes, I think that's why they call it the light of the festival of lights. There is all kind of shows for kids, Pestigal festival. Parents are busy taking kids from this show to another show. We call it the Chag of Festivalim.
So every day is a different festival.
Yeah, but I wanted to share with you something about Hanukkah in Israel. This Hanukkah will be very special for our partnership region, since we have a new connection between so many classes in Temple Emmanuel, with 6 different classes in whole school, Harel school, and kids both in Temple here in Tucson and in Harel school in Israel, will share how they affect, using Hanukkah theme, how they affect the world, how their light enlight the world.
How their light shines into the whole world.
Exactly.
Right. How it illuminates the world.
Yeah, their good deeds. So it's also about connecting Tucson to Israel and good deeds. It's all about Hanukkah.
Couldn't be a better theme for Hanukkah. Thank you again, Chag Urim Sameach.
Thank you, Rabbi.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Jews of France, the long and complicated relationship. By and large, not nearly as bad as it's portrayed today. Let's talk about France after World War II, after it welcomed many of the Holocaust refugees and DP camp survivors, and then Israel was founded in 1948. France was one of the early sponsors of Israel.
Right. It's fair to say that Israel would not have survived this long without active French support in several senses, political, economic, and especially military. The Israelis won the Six-Day War flying French jets.
Mirage jets, right.
The French were Israel's strongest allies in the Suez conflict in 1956. French engineers and nuclear physicists enabled Israel to build Dimona, its nuclear reactor.
That's when Shimon Peres did all of the, he was fluent in French, did all of the kind of negotiation.
Right.
So Israel,
for better or for
been...
worse, Israel is the only nuclear power in the Middle East. Iran is questionable. And it has been so for a long time.
Yeah, more than 40 years. Well, 40
more,
years.
40 year, more than 40 years.
Probably, yeah.
Thanks to the French. Eventually, French support for Israel weakened, but it never disappeared completely. It just became less obvious and less dramatic than it was in the 50s and 60s. Israel somehow lost a lot of European support in the years between the Six-Day War and the outbreak of the First Intifada. I would say that that is largely due not to a resurgence of anti-Semitism in Europe, but to a failure of the part of the Israeli government that was responsible for public relations, what the Israelis call hasbara and some people call propaganda, but whatever. The public image of Israel in Europe took a beating in the 1970s, and the beating got worse in the 80s. And the left-wing Europeans who saw Israel as a fellow socialist democracy in the 50s and 60s eventually came to see Israel as a colonial racist state. And for better or for worse, popular forces on the left in Europe undermined what had been systematic support for Israel, both military, economic, social, political, diplomatic, et cetera, et cetera. But the key point here is not even so much that, because that support for the state of Israel, that is nothing really to do with the French attitude toward Jews living in France. Those are really separate issues. And the Jews living in France thrived with no problem through at least the end of the 60s. And then something happened that was fairly dramatic. And I think we should devote next week's session to that something and to the recent past, which has unfairly tarnished the image of France in the eyes of world Jewry, because people stop at the end of the headline and don't read the rest of the story.
Well, we will get to the rest of the story next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two big Texans in cowboy hats are sitting on a plane from Dallas, and there's an old Jewish guy sitting between them. The first Texan says, "My name is Roger. I own 250,000 acres. I have 1,000 head of cattle. They call my place the Jolly Roger." The second Texan says, "Pleased to know you. My name is John. I own 350,000 acres. I have 5,000 head of cattle. They call my place Big John's." They both look down at the little old Jewish man between them, who says, "Well, my name is Irving. I only own 300 acres. Roger looks down at him and snorts, "300 acres? What do you raise?" "Nothing," says Irving. "Well then, what do you call it?" asks John. And Irving answers, "I call my place Downtown Dallas." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayigash begins with a climax of the great Joseph story that fills the last sections of the book of Genesis. Joseph is now the powerful ruler of Egypt, richest country in the ancient world. His miraculous ascent from slavery and then prison to the heights of political power is the stuff dreams are made of. He is the master of all he surveys, subservient only to a pharaoh who trusts him completely. Joseph is handsome, rich, hugely powerful, well-dressed, has a wife and two fine sons, completely assimilated into Egypt's elegant culture, and still comparatively young. The world sits at his manicured feet. Into this idyllic scene blunder Joseph's early tormentors, the very half-brothers who taunted and beat him up. These are the conniving thugs who stripped him and tossed him into a pit in the earth and sat down to eat lunch, debating in his hearing whether to kill him or just abandon him to die of thirst and starvation, and then ultimately sold him into slavery in a foreign land, taking a profit on the deal. Now, 20 years later, Joseph has the opportunity to return the favor, to exact at least a psychological vengeance on these half-brothers. After a sequence of twists and turns, Joseph has manipulated these brothers into a state of confusion and terror, and unmanned the arrogant, unruly rural ruffians into fearful submission. He has had his dish of revenge served cold, and seems to have enjoyed it. And then something changes in Joseph. Perhaps he simply tires of psychologically tormenting his half-brothers. Perhaps it is that he has finally seen his full brother Benjamin again, only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. Perhaps it's that the fullest measure of revenge is magnanimity to the defeated. Perhaps it's simply that Joseph's exceptional ability to act pragmatically exerts itself, and he must end the cat-and-mouse game one way or another. Or perhaps it's the stirring confessional speech that his powerful half-brother Judah delivers at the beginning of Vayigash that brings Joseph to a new place. Whatever the reason, in the dramatic high point of the story, Joseph chooses to reunite with his family. At the beginning of our portion, he sends his advisors, counselors, and courtiers from the room. Overcome by emotion, he cries out in a voice loud enough to be heard by all, telling the brothers, "He is Joseph. Weeping, he embraces his full brother Benjamin, asking, "Is my father still alive?" One can imagine the shock of that moment, even now, 3,600 years after the events described. The brothers may have had an inkling that he was indeed Joseph. It's implied in the story, but the full revelation would have been stunning nonetheless. Their worst fears are realized. They have been and are now completely in the power of a despised half-brother they comprehensively wronged. What will happen? Joseph moves immediately to reassure them and relieve their fears, and he reminds them that he is the authority now. Everyone will come down to Egypt and live in land that Joseph provides. Even his elderly father Jacob comes down. The family is reassembled, but in a very different configuration, for the unquestioned new patriarch is Joseph, and the great story will continue in a new land and a new direction. There's something here that compels us to examine our assumptions about just how things work in the world. Unpredictable things occur. What we expect is often not what occurs. Fate plays a role. The last can rise to first, and justice may ultimately be done. And in the best of circumstances, and with God's help, our own actions, like Joseph's, can begin with base motivation, yet finally rise to a level of magnanimity and grace. May it be so. When we return in a moment, here on Too Jewish, our guest, comedian Joel Chasnoff, will explain why Brist jokes are not really so funny, and just what is. And it's probably not the news of Jews around the world.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquidaki Tribe.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
This is a season of miracles for Jews, a time when we say the prayer Al HaNisim, thanking God for the miracles wrought for our ancestors at this time of year many centuries ago. But perhaps miracles still occur. Somehow the unjust arrest and five-year imprisonment of a Jewish contractor for the U.S. aid organization led to the end of a 50-year embargo and the normalizing of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and the Castro regime this past week. In a contemporary Hanukkah miracle, Alan Gross, held in abusive confinement by Cuba, was released last week. Held unjustly for 5 years, the 65-year-old American contractor was finally freed from his Cuban prison on the first day of Hanukkah. In a landmark humanitarian prisoner exchange announced by President Obama at the White House, the agreement followed more than a year of secret back-channel talks at the highest levels. The net result is the sudden end of the 50-year U.S. embargo of communist Cuba, the opening of a U.S. embassy in Havana to come, and a great price on Havana cigars. Maybe we should light our Chanukiot with Monte Cristos this year. The release of Alan Gross, who is in terrible physical condition, represented a dramatic step towards normalizing relations with a communist neighbor embargoed 90 miles off the Florida coast for half a century. Alan Gross was convicted of espionage by a Cuban court in 2011 and sentenced to 15 years for bringing telecommunications devices into Cuba while working as a subcontractor for the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. Gross contended he was importing parts that would help the Cuban Jewish community increase its ties to the outside world. Instead, the Cuban government accused him of being party to a U.S.-led plot to overthrow the government through an Arab Spring. Following a recent visit, Gross's attorney had described him as nearly toothless, barely able to walk because of arthritis in his hips, blind in one eye. He had been kept in a small room in a military hospital 24 hours a day with two other Cuban political prisoners for 5 years. Gross refused medical or dental care or outside privileges, declined visits and food from the U.S. interest section in Havana. He had promised a hunger strike leading to death if not released by the end of 2014. Well, now he's free. In return for Gross, the U.S. agreed to the humanitarian release of three Cuban agents convicted of espionage in a controversial trial that found them guilty of spying on anti-Castro groups in Miami, but not on the U.S. government. All three were held in North Carolina at a federal medical facility in the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. The humanitarian release is the beginning of a promised new relationship with Cuba. The White House has begun talks on everything from lifting travel restrictions to ending the Cuban embargo, which has been in place since John F. Kennedy was president. Maybe dates back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Alan Gross himself served USAID in many countries around the globe without prior incidents. Mazel tov to Alan Gross and to his family. I guess we should all start looking into visiting Cuba before it gets too modern. In much more distressing news, a European court annulled Hamas's inclusion on a blacklist of terror groups, saying the 2001 decision to put them on the terrorist group blacklist was based on the press and on internet reports, but not on legal reasoning. The decision last week by the Luxembourg-based General Court of the European Union kept Hamas's assets frozen for 3 months pending appeals and emphasized that it does not imply any substantive assessment on the question of the classification of Hamas as a terrorist group. The General Court finds the contested measures are based not on acts examined and confirmed in decisions of competent authorities, but on factual imputations derived from the press and the internet. In a statement, Moshe Kanter, the president of the European Jewish Congress, ridiculed that reasoning. All the judges had to do was read the Hamas charter and then have someone translate the thousands of videos and statements released to the public in Arabic, which openly call for and glorify the murder of innocent civilians, men, women, and children, he said. Among many others, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu protested the removal, saying, "The burden of proof is on the EU. We expect them to immediately return Hamas to the list where everyone realizes they must be," Netanyahu said. "Hamas is a murderous terrorist organization whose charter says that its aim is to destroy Israel." Hamas's military wing was added to the first EU blacklist of terrorist groups, which was issued in the wake of the 9/11 attacks back in 2001. Hamas's political wing was blacklisted in 2003, 2 years later. The EU insists the removal of Hamas from the terrorism blacklist is strictly a procedural matter. It will be reversed once a dossier documenting the proper rationale is resubmitted. We can hope so. And finally, the Forward newspaper's annual survey of Jewish nonprofit leaders is out. It's their salary survey, and it's always an interesting one. I'm not sure just how comprehensive it truly is, but its top 25 or so, all of whom make over $400,000 a year, includes the presidents of Brandeis and Yeshiva Universities and Touro College, the heads of several major Jewish organizations like the ADL, the American Jewish Committee, the Joint Distribution Committee, Birthright Israel, and Hadassah, and no fewer than 10 federation presidents around the country. That is, in essence, a large proportion of the best-paid nonprofit Jewish leaders are employed raising money for federation. I'm not sure what this says about our Jewish community here in the U.S. On the political end of the salary survey, it's much better to be on the right side. Matt Brooks, a past guest of Two Jewish and head of the Republican Jewish Coalition, comes in at $562,000 a year, while Jack Moline, head of the National Jewish Democratic Council, makes just $171,000 annually, less than a third as much. Howard Kaur, the head of AIPAC now, makes $578,000 a year, while Jeremy Ben-Ami of J Street, another past guest of Two Jewish, makes a relatively paltry $214,000. According to the Forward, the single most underpaid Jewish nonprofit leader in all of America was Dr. Robert Wexler, head of American Jewish University in L.A., the conservative movement seminary there. He received slightly less than $200,000 last year, about half of what should have been expected for a nonprofit of that size. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our comedian guest this morning, Joel Chasnoff. He's one of the really wonderful, we used to say young comedians. When do you have to stop saying you're a young comedian?
Oh, man. Well, somebody, you know, I once performed with Dr. Katz. Remember Dr. Katz?
Oh, my gosh.
He had that cartoon show, and he he went on after me, and I did pretty well, and he had a little bit of a rough time, and he said, never follow a young comedian. So for a while, I was a young comedian, but now I'll perform, and I'll be on the bill with the guys who are younger, and I don't think the age matters. I think as long as you're good.
as long as you win. A tricky question. You do lots of jokes about Israel, do jokes about the Jewish world. Are there off-limit subjects for you? You know, the Gaza war last summer wasn't a lot of fun here in America. Are there things you don't talk about?
You know, I think everything can be spoken about. It's a matter of how you do it. I don't have jokes about the Gaza war. I do have jokes about the Israeli army, and I have jokes about Israel and how Israelis are resilient, and that ties in with the what happened in Gaza this summer. Last night, I performed at a fundraiser in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, for about 400 people there, and it was to raise money for the Lone Soldier Center. And the main speaker that night was Harriet Levin, who was the mother of Michael Levin, who was the lone soldier who was killed in 2006 in Lebanon from Philadelphia. And he was really the first lone soldier to raise, by his passing, like, it raised awareness about lone soldiers in general, both to Americans and to Israelis.
And just to explain, lone soldiers are often American, but not just American.
A lone soldier is someone who, outside of Israel, moves to Israel and serves in the army, but their parents are not in Israel. So that's, I was a lone soldier, and Michael was. And, you know, she gave a very meaningful speech and showed a video, and I was literally, I had tears in my eyes as I went up to the stage. That had never happened to me before, but it was just so moving. And, you know, people in the crowd, I think, were wondering, can comedy even fit here? And, you know, of course, I didn't have jokes about war, but I had jokes about what it means to be an American in this jungle of Israelis, what it means to be an outsider. And so every topic, I think, is doable. There are some American comedians who are doing really biting humor right now about what's happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York City with the grand jury decision. And it's just a matter of how they do it. And I think it's a matter of how close you are to the topic. I think I can make jokes about Israel that maybe others can't because I served in the army. And I think Chris Rock can make jokes about what happened in Ferguson in a way that I can't because of, you know, his attachment to the experience. So it also depends who's telling the joke.
All right, a very important question. Your parents dreamed of you growing up and becoming a comedian, right?
Oh, yeah, from a young age, schooling me. I mean, look, it was in my house, it was always about, great idea, but how are you going to support yourself? You know, what's your real job going to be? And actually, yeah, maybe part of that motivated me, but part of it, you know, sort of sent the message that you're not going to succeed, you're not going to make it. And with my own kids now, I really try to encourage them to, you know, to think about doing whatever they want to do. I really do believe that it'll work out.
You know, I sort of feel like in most Jewish homes, you're given a great deal of choice in what occupation. You could be any kind of doctor you want.
And, yeah, optometrist or ophthalmologist. I mean,
very broad range. Lots of possibilities.
Yeah.
When you were in the Israeli army and you wrote Crybaby Brigade, which is very funny, well, what for you was the funniest moment in the whole thing?
You mean the army experience?
The army experience itself.
Yeah, I mean, I do have one night that I remember in basic training where we were cleaning the kitchen. It was about 10 of us. And, you know, we just started doing goofy adolescent things like squirting each other with hoses and putting pots and pans on our heads and drumming them and, you know, ridiculously stupid adolescent stuff. But it's one of those things where the momentum builds and everyone is sort of trying to out-goof the other. That was, you know, that was one moment where in the moment I was laughing uncontrollably. Most of my funny memories are in retrospect. You know, now I'll look back now on what was happening in even Lebanon and realize just how ridiculous it was. But as for in the moment, you know, the one that stands out is probably that one.
Where do you look for your material? Does it just come?
I mean, I think material is everywhere. And I must admit, having, you know, being now on Twitter and Facebook, you have this opportunity that as soon as you see something funny, it doesn't just have to go in your notebook. You can, you know, share it with people who want to hear what you say. So that's helped me stay attuned to looking looking for things that I can, you know, tweet or update. And it is everywhere. It's a matter, though, of can you see it? I think what makes Seinfeld, or right now Jim Gaffigan, who's probably my favorite comedian right now, what makes them so great is not just that they write good jokes, well-structured jokes, but that they notice the inconsistencies in the smallest details. I mean, to be able to make 3 minutes of humor about bowling, as Jim Gaffigan does, I mean, that is where the real art is. Once you know how to write a joke, you can then, you know, structure it correctly. But to the real comedians, I think, you know, have that ability to find something wrong in even the most mundane situations. So it is everywhere if you know how to look.
You were in the Big Book of Jewish Humor, the 25th anniversary edition, kind of a big deal because, of course, there's a little competition there. Why are Jews funny, and why are so many Jews so prominent in comedy?
Well, I mean, there are many theories, many reasons. There's the underdog effect that, you know, all those years of tragedy, you know, tragedy plus time is comedy. And by being exiled and suffering, we were able to, you know, survive by using humor. And I think that's correct, but I think that sort of shortchanges the bigger picture. And I think the real reason has to do with just our history as a people. We're a very story-oriented people. We're an oral people. You know, we have the whole oral Torah in addition to the written Torah. So I think stories and using examples and stories as a way to learn something is in our blood. And the whole Talmud also is just one question answered with another question. And that's really what comedy is. It's a question. It's looking at something and having the chutzpah to ask a question and say, what is wrong with this? Why is this not the way it should be? And as long as Jews or anyone questions, then we'll continue to flourish in comedy. I do think it's changing. I don't think you see Jewish comics the way you used to because we're so assimilated now, and that's good that we're not persecuted, but it has taken away from our, you know, outside status, and I think you need a little bit of outside status. You need to feel like you don't fit in to be a good comedian. And so I don't think we're going to see Jewish comedy the way we used to.
Is really good comedy always edgy? Is there always a sharpness to it?
I don't think so. I think it can add something. The right insult done correctly will always make a joke a little bit funnier. But as I said, you know, when I was talking about Jim Gaffigan a few minutes ago, I mean, he has jokes about cheeseburgers and bowling, and there's no insult at all. If there is an insult, it's on himself. So maybe I should correct myself and say, yeah, there should be an insult, but it doesn't have to be at someone else's expense. I think the best comedians are able to have the insult on them. And even Seinfeld, where they say, well, he's doing jokes about nothing. Well, I think in a way he's sort of insulting our own mundane lives, the own absurdity of day-to-day life of the middle-class American. So that's a more subtle form of insult, but it's, I guess it's still there. So yeah, you know, calling attention to something absurd, insult, the line gets fuzzy. It does help.
All right, so in a competition, what's the funniest aspect of Jewish life? Now, I think there are probably more circumcision jokes than many other aspects, but what do you think the funniest thing? What has been the greatest source for you to mind?
For me, circumcision jokes, like, aren't funny just because they're too easy. Like, it's yeah. So obvious. I really prefer the humor that comes from picking out the absurdity inside the mundane. So, you know, for me, for Jewish life, it used to be life cycle events and bar mitzvahs because I was, you know, that was still fresh in my mind. And now that I have kids of my own, you know, the humor is coming from, you know, having kids in day school and what, you know, the absurdities there and the visiting Israel with my family and being married to an Israeli, you know, those kinds of things that make up my normal daily life. Trying to find the humor there. But, you know, circumcision jokes or, you know, annoying husband or wife jokes, they'll always get a laugh, but I want to just try to be a little more creative.
It's kind of a little too cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, and predictable. I mean, if you start a joke saying, well, this moil, whatever, well, you pretty much know how it's gonna end up.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean it's not funny. I've heard some good moil jokes, but
there are.
It doesn't mean it's funny.
Yeah, no, that's right. What I like about your humor is you really have a way of sort of getting into the psyche of the experience in what's often a very gentle but very funny way. What's your favorite recent joke?
Of my own?
Yes. Well, you can steal, because I am told that on occasion comedians borrow from other comedians.
Oh, yeah. No, actually, I don't borrow. Like, I've actually had jokes that I heard someone else later on do, and they probably did it later than me, and I've dropped the joke just because I don't want any... I used to have a great joke that I was doing for years about having to buy tickets on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah for the high holidays and looking for a scalper. And then Larry David did something about that on his show, and people would come to me and say, oh, you got that from his show. And I had to drop it because there was, of course I didn't take it, but there was that, you know, people could think so. So I didn't. My favorite joke right now is actually one that I'm not sure I can say on the radio, because I have a clean act, but once in my act, will I swear. And you know what I do? When I perform for Chabad, I do a different version, so I'll give you the Chabad.
All right, this is the Chabad version of the joke. Okay.
Yeah, here's the Chabad version. I say that being married to an Israeli, you know, she never apologized. Once in all my years of marriage, only once that she apologized, and it wasn't even a real apology, it was an Israeli apology. We had this huge fight that almost led to divorce, but sadly did not. And a week later, she came to me and gave me an Israeli apology. She said, Joel, I'm sorry, you're such an idiot. Now... instead of idiots, you can substitute, you know, words that begin with A or, you know, something else. But, you know, the idea is that the Israeli, when apologizing, will still find a way to make you to make you look bad. And that just gets a huge reaction from crowds. And I love telling it because it's kind of close to home.
It really does. I do remember in Israel, the one word that you never heard was slicha.
Right. It's the first word you learn in Jewish day school, but no, you're never going
to
actually use it.
Yeah, you walk up to somebody and say slicha, and they know immediately. It doesn't matter how good your accent, you're not only from another country, you're from another planet. You're not really part of the culture.
Exactly.
So, do you want your kids to grow up to be comedians?
I don't want them to grow up to be anything other than open-minded, creative, and, you know, true to themselves. I would love it if they went into comedy and I do think they have a good sense of humor, but it would have to be right for them. It's a lifestyle choice as well. It's a lot of fun, but it's not always simple.
Joel, you teach stand-up comedy. I remember, you know, there's some great bits about, oh boy, in my favorite year, there's a part where the guy tries to teach the girl how to tell a joke, and she can't do it. Do you ever have people like that?
You know, in my classes, sure, there are some who come in with a more... you know, more ready to perform, and there are those who just can't. I do believe there's such a thing as talent. I mean, I teach improv comedy, too. And there are some who, you know, slowly get it and get better, but there are also those who just have it. Like, just from the moment we begin, they have this sort of energy about them that you just can see they've got it. And I believe that phenomenon exists. In all walks of life, not just, you know, the stage. There's just some people who, whether it's a teacher or, you know, I've seen teachers and probably other professions as well, that they just got it. So I do think that everybody can learn stand up, and whatever a person's deficiency is, you need to work that into your act. If you're not confident and you're sort of nebbishy, and even if you have a stutter, well, your goal is not to try to overcome that in doing stand-up. Your goal is to integrate that into your character.
It worked pretty well for Woody Allen, as I recall.
Well, right, there you go. I mean, he could have, you know, said, I'm going to try to be like a Andrew Dice Clay and strong, but that wouldn't have worked for him. But being that cerebral, heady guy fits with his material, and so anyone can learn it. But it is a matter of, you got to go up on stage, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of times. You can't read a book about stand-up or take a class and master it.
By the way, I can tell you that being a rabbi in the pulpit does not count as stand-up comedy, but a lot of people think it does, mostly rabbis.
I think a lot of rabbis think it does.
Isn't it tragic?
You know, you give anyone a public forum, and I know so many, many funny rabbis, and often, you know, I'll do a completely clean show. It'll be the rabbi who comes up to me afterwards and says, here's a joke.
And it's filthy, of course.
Right. I'm almost embarrassed. I'm ashamed of hearing this from
this. So. But I got it from the Chabad rabbi this time.
Yeah, well, believe me, there's...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard stories. I want to thank Joel Chestnut for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And you can go to his website. It's joelchasnoff.com, C-H-A-S-N-O-F-F. Joel, thanks and happy Hanukkah.
Sam, always a pleasure. Hope we do it again.
Me too. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Rabbi Benji Levine of the Remarkable Gesher Organization, which builds bridges between secular and religious Jews of every kind in Israel and around the world. He is the 2014 Kohan Foundation Award winner for Jewish Unity. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish is for Hanukkah, of course, with apologies to Taylor Swift. It's a parody of Shake It Off by the a cappella group 613, and it's called, appropriately, Hanukkah. My friends, have a Chag Orim Sameach, a happy holiday of lights, a Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy beginning to the festival of Hanukkah, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
I'm feeling pretty great.